Today on the Your Hometown Tour, we take you south to Will County and a lovely village named Bonnie. Hop aboard. It's the Your Hometown Tour, sponsored by Illinois Lottery, doing good and supporting Illinois communities, and by McDonald's.
Your hometown today is Mony, Illinois. That's Steve Bertrand's kind of country, if I'm not mistaken. Darren Freihage is a McDonald's owner and operator and the owner of that restaurant in Mony. Darren, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Tell me about your business. How long have you been an owner-operator of McDonald's?
I've been a McDonald's owner-operator now for 30 years. I did start out as a crew member, and I worked my way up to supervisor and eventually owner-operator in February of 1994, where I bought my first two restaurants in Tinley Park.
So you're kind of the prototypical McDonald's success story.
Correct. I'm a third generation, actually.
Oh, no kidding. So when you were first working there as a kid, was that your family's restaurant?
Yes, I did work in a friend of ours restaurant at one point in time, my first stint, which was probably 1983, and then eventually started working in our restaurants full-time in 1986.
What is it, something like 1 in 7 or 1 in 11 Americans or something like that have worked at a McDonald's at some point in their lives?
I've heard 1 in 7.
Yeah. So you now are in Mony. Where are your other stores?
The surrounding area, southern suburbs of Chicago.
And how's business these days?
Business as well. It's always a challenge with all the different things going on, but we have different promotions coming up, but we're happy. We're blessed, and the McDonald's brand has been good to our family.
Well, there's a couple of menu items that I think are getting a little buzz. Didn't I see a Big Mac with a chicken filet on there instead of ground beef?
Yes, you did hear that correctly.
How's that going?
We're going actually pretty well. Movement has been a little bit more than I anticipated, so that's always good news.
So that's just like a Big Mac, but with chicken on there, right?
Exactly.
Is it two slices of chicken or just one?
It's two.
And then I guess the other menu item people are talking about are the Krispy Kreme donuts, right?
Yes, of course. Lots of talk about Krispy Kreme. I've been eating them for decades myself, and now that we have them in our restaurants, it's very exciting to offer something with such a good brand name behind it.
Well, McDonald's is well known for its coffee, so I guess having a donut, particularly that one there, is good for business as well.
Perfect combination.
Do you have family that are behind you now? You said you're third generation. Do you have a fourth generation in the business?
I do. My son, Cass, just became eligible to be an owner-operator in July of 2024, and very soon he'll be having his own restaurant. And he started working for me when he was in high school, and he went to college and then came back and started working full-time about 10 years ago, and here we are. He'll be a fourth-generation Freihage.
And then what does it mean to be a McDonald's owner-operator? Just talk a little bit about your place in the community, your feelings about Mony.
Specifically, Mony, it's a smaller town, and I do have a couple locations in some small towns, and it seems like because of the smaller towns are more, community involved. And I tend to know people in these smaller towns that we operate in a little bit more. And Mony is one of those. It's about that size where it tends to be very community oriented. And the town of Mony has really been accepted us well in our location. And we're very happy to be in that town. It's been a very good, it's a blessing to us to be there.
What do you mean by that, though? Give me a sense of why you feel like there's more community involvement in your town and at your restaurant.
I guess you get to know people in the town more than in the bigger towns. That's just from my experience. I know that, some people that operate in larger towns, they have involvement with their alderman or the mayor or whatever. But from what I can tell, it's a little bit more intimate, I guess.
It seems to me, my experience has been that it's almost a meeting place for people, too.
For sure. But that happens everywhere, though. That you always have the same groups in the different stores. So, one thing about being in McDonald's, you always have your core customers that keep coming back, and, you get to know them over time. That's part of one of the things that's rewarding, because you make good relationships with people and your customers and your staff as well.
Yeah.
The staff tends to be primarily from where you do business, and that's important to us also.
Talk a little bit about your crew. I know hiring and keeping people is always a challenge, especially these days, it seems, but just tell me a little bit about the people that work for you.
Again, they're primarily from the community that we do business in, so that is another way that we can be involved with the local community, not just by selling hamburgers and soft drinks, but by providing jobs for the local community, especially the kids that are, you know, growing up, and the parents want them to get some experience. But primarily it's younger kids. Sometimes you have moms that want to stay active. Sometimes you have retired people come in and they want to keep busy. But it's a really good balance of younger, older, middle-aged, depending on what their particular requirements are and what their needs are.
I would imagine it's kind of interesting to see a young person evolve, you know, learn a little responsibility, gain a little confidence, make mistakes, learn from them, that sort of thing.
Yes, that happens quite a bit. And we actually prefer to take someone who's brand new with no experience so that we can mold them to our quality standards instead of having to retrain them from, you know, working in other locations that maybe don't have our standards.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a good business. It sounds like you're doing it right. My best to your family, my best to your staff and customers, Darren.
Well, thank you for checking in with us, and we're happy to be in the town of Moni.
Yeah, and by the way, I had one of those Krispy Kreme donuts, and it was pretty good. Don't tell Don Jackson Blattner that, but tell Darren thank you over at the McDonald's in Moni and some of the surrounding areas. Joining us now, Bree Fowler on the Wintrust Business Lunch, senior writer at CNET. Hi, Bree. Happy Halloween.
Hey, happy Halloween. Great to be with you.
You dressing up?
No, I don't think so. I haven't quite figured that out yet, but I do have a whole bunch of people coming over later, so it should be fun.
You going to have an orange punch?
No, I don't think there'll be any punch. It's a lot of kids, so, you know, just the usual stuff.
Candy and whatnot. So Let's talk a little bit about Microsoft. On Wednesday, quarterly sales, $66 billion. Wow.
Yeah, they did great in the eyes of investors. And it's all to show that their big spending that they've been doing lately on artificial intelligence is finally starting to pay off. This was definitely a case of having to spend money to make money, because Microsoft has spent billions of dollars to expand its network of data centers and physical infrastructure that you need to develop AI.
Do we think we know that AI is going to achieve the promise? Is it too soon to tell, or are reports like this evidence that it's not a flash in the pan? This is the future. It's real. It's monetizable, so forth.
Yeah, it's definitely a sign of that. AI, you know, Microsoft is integrating it into the products that they sell customers, and customers are buying them. Now, whether AI needs to be there or it's making any kind of, you know, productivity difference remains to be seen, but, you know, customers are paying for it right now.
Speaking of AI, it just makes me think of Elon Musk and all of his ventures. And I saw that the Justice Department has said, a judge has said, that he can't give out $1 million to people that sign a pledge to essentially vote for Team Trump. Any thoughts or observations about that?
You know, it's definitely interesting because, you know, you can't pay people to vote. And yeah, Pennsylvania officials there were definitely leery about this one. You know, these were people at Trump rallies, and he's giving it away to a random person who, you know, vows to register. He doesn't, you know, it's not contingent on who they vote for, but, you know, we know where that money's going.
The deck does seem to be stacked. And one of the reports I saw said that you also cannot pay people to register.
Right.
And that's sure does seem to be what's happened. A judge has so concurred. Talk to me about semiconductors. What's this facility in New York? Why do I care?
Well, I mean, it's more money from the 2022 CHIPS Act, more jobs, more investment in places like upstate New York that just, you know, they've lost a lot of their manufacturing sector. This is, you know, a shot in the arm for a region that needs it. It's $825 million in funding. And it is part of that broader effort to, you know, get us to make chips here and make us less dependent on chip makers overseas. And, you know, it's not a car parts factory. You need a lot of money, and these things can't be built overnight.
This comes at the expense of what? Taiwan, maybe? I suppose China is ultimately in the rearview mirror there, or coming at us. But Taiwan does a lot of that too, right?
Right. And the problem with Taiwan is if there were ever some kind of armed conflict that made it hard for us to get stuff from them, we could have some serious supply chain issues.
It's a lesson we should have learned during the pandemic when it wasn't armed conflict, but there was a shutdown. Better that we're able to produce this ourselves. Back to X for a moment now.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me about the fact checking they are and are not doing relative to the election.
Yeah, we've had so much disinformation and misinformation and just general craziness and outright lying this year with the election. And social media has been a huge part of it. And X, formerly known as Twitter, you know, when Elon Musk took over, they got rid of a lot of the content moderation and people in charge of that. Instead, you know, crowdsourcing from users, if there was something wrong, letting certain people who are pre-approved do things called community notes, where they could kind of flag posts as disinformation or inaccuracies. And this hasn't quite been working out as well as that they would have hoped.
Or maybe it's working out exactly the way. I'm not kidding. I mean, we know, look, Elon Musk might be in Donald Trump's cabinet if he's to win the election. He's obviously putting tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars into the campaign. You saw the story about what the Wall Street Journal did. They opened up a bunch of anonymous, if you will, X accounts in states like Pennsylvania. Uh-huh. And then they saw it when they only indicated their interest would be baseball and art and family fun. They didn't say they were into politics. And now they're being flooded with political posts, which 11 to 14 were very conservative in their leanings. I don't know what you call that, but that's not being a neutral source. That's actually feeding people content that favors one side.
Right. And even if you don't follow Elon Musk, he's one of those top posts that will magically appear in your feed when you open up X on a given day. I mean, they've definitely tweaked the algorithms to give preference to certain kinds of posts. And, you know, the research study here is showing that, you know, while these footnotes are there on a lot of posts, they're not getting nearly as much traffic as the disinformation that they're responding to.
I'm sorry, what do you mean by that?
Well, the according to the study, which was done for the Center for Countering Digital Hate, they analyzed the community notes feature and found that that, you know, 209 out of 283 of them were misleading, and
really?
Misleading posts didn't display the community notes even when they were available. And they included false claims about the 2020 election being stolen, and the fact-checking posts that responded to them did not get the traffic. So, you know, millions of views for the disinformation, but much fewer for the people calling it out.
Bree Fowler is a senior writer at CNET.com. My best to your family tonight. Have a good day.
Thanks, you too.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. On the monitors next to me, I see four of the major news networks, including our own News Nation. Over and over again, I see video of Donald Trump 3 days before the election driving around in a garbage truck. Kamala Harris is talking about lofty ideals of saving democracy. And I said on the Mincing Rascals podcast this week, I guess this is bad advertising, but I wish they would talk more about some of the nuts and bolts economic issues that really will change our lives for the better or the worse. And that's why we turn to Michael Miller today, an economics professor at Western Washington University. He's a professor emeritus over at DePaul, where we first met him. He's out west now, but he still joins us on WGN. Hi, Mike. Welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back with you, and happy Halloween.
Yeah. Do they celebrate that? And you're in Canada, right?
Oh, no. I'm in Washington State. I'm 9 miles from the Canadian border.
we'll run over there and ask them if they hand out candy. I don't know if they do it like we do or not.
I don't know. I have to try that sometime.
So you heard my little send-up.
I did.
What would you say are the most important economic issues or barriers on the horizon that maybe they're addressing, maybe they aren't? But I mean, just from an economic standpoint, what should we pay attention to?
Well, I would like to see the candidates talk more about their economic policy, and they don't. They both seem to, through inaction, The Democrats are continuing the tariffs that were created by Mr. Trump, and economists in general are not fans, big fans of tariffs. Mr. Trump has called for more tariffs to be put on things. I wish they would talk more about regulation to make sure that regulations are put into place if and only if they have a benefit to society that is greater than the cost that they incur, but they don't talk about that. Also, you know, that every president gets to choose the head of the Federal Reserve, the chair of the Federal Reserve, and that seat will be coming up early in the next term.
Yeah.
And I've heard no discussion as to will they continue on with Jerome Powell? Will they put in somebody different? What is their intention in terms of the independence of the Fed? Do they want it to be? And they just don't talk about these very, what I think are very important things.
Former President Trump had targeted tariffs, which you mentioned the administration's continuing. The difference would be the level, perhaps, to which the tariffs would go were Trump to be elected. It would then approach $3 trillion worth of commerce, and that would stymie our economy, I've been told. But would you say that targeted tariffs do serve a purpose?
Well, they can. You know, you were just discussing with your previous guest about what about something like chips that are made in, say, South Korea or Taiwan. What if there were a problem? What if there were, Taiwan was attacked by China and all of a sudden they decided they weren't going to sell them to us? You know, tariffs are a useful tool for two reasons. One would be to protect what is called an infant industry, where you're trying to get a brand new industry off the ground. And the second one would be when you're trying to protect the country in terms of national security, that you can't let an industry go out of business because of foreign competition, which would leave you then without that industry if we had to be isolated because of some kind of international conflict. So you can't not have food. You can't not have, say, steel. And in today's world, I wonder if we cannot have a country where we produce, you know, no chips. We have to be sure that we can create the chips necessary to run all of the machines that we have. And so some targeted tariffs can certainly make sense. What is disappointing about Mr. Trump is he thinks it can actually replace much of the income tax, which I think, and he's been told by his economic advisors, because I've heard them talk on the air, it's just a silly idea. Tariffs will not generate that kind of income. And he does look at it as a very powerful political tool to use against our trading partners. And while there is some truth in that, I think he overstates very much how powerful tariffs can be, because they are damaging. They are damaging to Americans. And I think that both parties need to realize that. As Mr. Biden, of course, never removed the tariffs that were put on by the Trump administration.
I wonder how reciprocal it would be were we to up the game, you know?
That's one of the questions is, and of course, that's a word that Mr. Trump uses. He talks about reciprocal relationships. And his idea is that, of course, if you look at like the European Union, they have some tariffs on that people don't even really know about, which I did not know about. And if we would put on tariffs, and then maybe we could get them to the negotiating table, and we would together lower tariffs across the board, which would be good for trade because it allows specialization and all the gains that you get from specialization. So that's the political side to it. See, there's one thing about tariffs, it does not have just an economic impact. It has a political one as well. And anybody who is in the seat of the presidency and trying to direct some kind of economic policy recognizes that dual purpose for a tariff. And what you have to do is try to find that fine line where you can actually get our trading partners to be, to use the only word I can come up with, to be more fair in their trade with us.
Right.
And at the same time, protect the country's jobs from any kind of predatory activity from outside.
Well, that's the word I was just thinking about, fair. Some countries prop up their own industries so as to protect them. It, I guess, would be the equivalent impact of a tariff here. It would make it more difficult for us to compete. In general, yep. How fair would you say the playing field is? Are we being taken advantage of on the world market or not?
I think we're doing much better than we used to. I know that almost both candidates have talked about, but mainly Mr. Trump has talked about that the world of trade is unfair. I think he overstates that case. There are certain industries where, in certain countries, where they are, of course, protecting their own, which is understandable, and then we don't do anything against them. So we don't, in a sense, the word we use in economics is retaliate. So if somebody puts on a high tariff on us, well, we retaliate and put one on them. And, of course, that's the fear that most economists have, is were we to put some very, very high tariffs on, say, the Chinese markets or other markets, these other countries will retaliate against us in the sense of putting tariffs on the people that sell to them.
But accepting all of this, if I go to Walmart or Costco, I can get stuff really inexpensively, and it's made overseas. So I just wonder what would happen to the prices of those things if this trade war escalates.
Well, they would rise. There's just no doubt, because when a tariff is imposed, in 95% of the cases, of course, the domestic market pays a higher price. Now, in any tariff, there's going to be a winner, and that's going to be the industry which is being protected within the United States, the employees and those companies. The government will win in terms of getting some additional revenue, but the loser is always, almost always, the American consumer, in that the price of the good they buy from overseas will be higher. And even the domestic alternative, when the price of the foreign good goes up, it gives the domestic producer some room to raise their prices, yet still remain below their competitor. So within the U.S., then, prices pretty much go up across the board on the goods which are being protected. And you and I pay for all that.
We'll pick it up here in a minute. We're talking to Mike Miller. He is a professor of economics at Western Washington University. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A $75 million donation from the AbbVie Foundation will help University of Chicago Medicine build its new cancer hospital on Chicago's south side. The new building will be called the AbbVie Foundation Center Cancer Pavilion and has a completion date in 2027. The freestanding facility will include 575,000 square feet of space with an estimated cost of $815 million. UChicago Medicine says the facility will give Southside residents better access to cancer care. It'll also attract patients from across the region. Experts say cancer death rates on the Southside are nearly double the national average. It's a leading cause of death in several neighborhoods, including Kenwood, South Deering, and Woodlawn. The AbbVie Foundation is a nonprofit organization that aims to advance health equity. The food hall trend may be losing popularity even outside of downtown Chicago. The X Market Food Hall in the Uptown neighborhood is closing. It's located at 804 West Montrose and has been open only about a year with a focus on vegan options. X Market Food Hall includes 7 vendors. There's also a bar and bodega. The space also hosted events like concerts and trivia night. It's managed by a company based in West Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now, dressed as an agribusiness reporter, the business of food with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And that double whammy of hurricanes Helene and Milton did a number on agriculture.
Between both storms, most of Florida was hit, and then Helene also really impacted agriculture in Georgia and North Carolina as well.
And the damage to many of the things we love to eat is not known yet, but
about $15 billion in annual agricultural production was in the pathway of Helene, and about $7.4 billion was in the pathway of Milton.
And we are talking about tomatoes and strawberries and oranges and poultry and other livestock and much more after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
I'm Betty Resnick, and I'm an economist at the American Farm Bureau Federation.
And the Farm Bureau is helping us understand how severe the storm damage was to agriculture. Let's begin with pecans in Georgia.
We've lost probably over 400,000 pecan trees. About 8% of total U.S. production of pecans was in the pathway of the storm. And it takes over a decade for pecan trees to reach maturity. So this is not a short-term problem.
How about fresh tomatoes?
Florida grows about 70% of the country's fresh tomatoes. And two of the top counties for that were both severely impacted by the storm.
What about strawberries?
13% of our nation's domestically produced strawberries are grown in Florida. and almost all of Florida strawberry production was in the pathway of these storms.
How about citrus?
I will say that the Florida citrus industry was already barely hanging on before these hurricanes.
And?
If trees were lost, if any floodwater touches any part of an edible plant, it has to be disposed of and it can't be served.
The storms were a life-altering tragedy for so many people, but for the rest of us?
The American food supply is incredibly resilient, so we might see some bumps along the road for a couple of products, but overall, I don't know if your average consumer in Chicago is going to feel the impacts.
On the food calendar, it's National Caramel Apple Day, or do you say...
Caramel.
I'm Steve...
Caramel.
Yeah, okay, got it.
Caramel.
Yes, sir. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Michael Miller's on the line. He's an economics professor at Western Washington University. We met him when he was at DePaul. Immigration, Mike, for a minute... Trump team says that they will immediately begin exporting the migrants who are undocumented here and maybe some others as well. Is there any way to calculate the impact that the exodus of these people would have on the economy?
Well, there would be two aspects to it. One would be the effect upon the labor force in terms of how much are they participating in the actual labor activity. Are they holding down jobs? And how many jobs and how many hours are they working? Are they doing jobs that are very hard to fill with Americans? And if you take a lot of people out of the market that have those characteristics, that could hurt the economy, certainly in the short run, if not in the long run. And then the second piece is that these people, they do have to live. They do spend money. So certainly there will be the demand side of it in that we would remove them from the economy. Their spending would go with them. It would go to wherever country they're going back to. So it would have, in some sense, two negative effects upon the economy, one from the supply side and one from the demand side. So before we would make any such move, we have to make sure that we're doing it, I guess, with the lack of a better word, again, as fairly as possible, and that we are calculating the cost and the benefits to the country of that particular action.
With unemployment at about 4%, if we toss a lot of people out of the country, many of whom are doing jobs that a lot of us would prefer not to do, I wonder who would fill those positions. And if it were to be people who have other jobs and would change over to them, or who are unemployed but would take them, I wonder what would happen to their wages and the subsequent costs for the rest of us.
The wages would rise, that's for sure. Now, I think the hope is that there are a fair number of men between the age of 25 and 54 who are still on the sidelines.
Who aren't being counted.
Haven't affected women as much as men.
And isn't there a population of people who aren't being counted when we say 4% unemployment?
Well, there are broader definitions of unemployment that what we have is what is called the U6, and then there's we can look at discouraged workers and marginally attached workers to the labor force and so forth. So the unemployment rate that we report is the lowest of all the possible unemployment rates.
Right.
And another thing is that that there are certain skills that are brought, like you say, certain skills that are brought by immigrants. Now, I think that Mr. Trump is focusing mainly upon immigrants who are committing crimes, who are here illegally and committing crimes. At least I hope that's the only people he's talking about. I would not want to see him go after immigrants in general in any way because of the problems which I've just mentioned to you. And in terms of replacement, this is aggravated further by the fact of the baby boom generation. People my age are retiring in very large numbers and maybe with no desire to go back to work after retiring. And that makes it harder for firms to find employees. And by throwing out immigrants, you're just making the labor force more inefficient and more costly. And I think that that's a mistake.
I don't know anybody that wants to process chickens or pick strawberries, but that work is being done right now. And often it is by people that are not from the USA. There was a story in the paper the other day about one of the fastest growing metropolitan areas in America is a part of Arkansas, where Tyson Foods processes a lot of chickens. Mm-hmm. And the labor force there is largely Mexican-American or Spanish-speaking. if those people all went away, and maybe some of them aren't documented, that would impact that economy, and it would impact the price of chickens.
Absolutely, it would. And what we are finding as well is that within America, say much more so than other countries, people become American so much more quickly than and adapt to it and become integrated into society much faster than in many other countries, because America is in a sense so open to immigration and have been for several hundred years. And so it seems like it's a very big influx, and that can be disruptive. But those people will become Americans. They will fit in, and that's what all the data do show. Immigration is, of course, can have costs, but on net, especially in the long run, immigration is a very strong positive.
Yeah, and I don't know that he could do it, but Donald Trump is talking about mass migration, mass deportation, MASS, the operative part of that.
And right. I meant.
I'll leave it at that. You and I will talk about federal dollars for public policy and other issues next time, Michael. It's always a pleasure to visit with you.
You got it, John. I enjoyed the discussion very much.